Please welcome Ellen C. from Addison, Texas.
It doesn't say that relative or friend says they're an alcoholic. It says, I believe there's a problem of alcoholism. That's what it says. And what I know today is that the addiction to the substance alcohol can skip a generation. God, John's family is amazing. Holy smokes. The addiction to alcohol can actually skip a generation, but the incessant need to control never skips a generation. It gets passed down. Yeah, he knows. It gets passed down faithfully, generation to generation. And that's what I got. I got that. I'm in Al-Anon not because of those people in my life. One of them got me here. One of them. I could point at him and said I was here because of his bad behavior, but I wasn't here in Al-Anon very long before I realized I was here because of my own bad behavior. I had turned into somebody I didn't like and somebody I couldn't trust. And my world had gotten incredibly small. I'm in Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. I'm convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. And the longer I'm here, the more legacies I gain. I am now into the concepts, my friends. Don't go there alone. But boy, is there some great stuff out there. There's great stuff out there. I got a 36 legacy program now that I practice like my life depends on it. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor. And she knows she's my sponsor. Sometimes I think we need a little checklist in Al-Anon that says, number one, do you have a sponsor? Number two, does she know she's your sponsor? Because we do this thing in Al-Anon about, oh, I don't want to bother anybody, you know. Listen, if somebody agreed to be your sponsor, they agreed to be bothered. This is a good place to start learning boundaries. You make the call when you need to make the call and let your sponsor decide whether they could be bothered right now or not. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison, Texas Al-Anon family group meeting, and that's where I'll be. Even on Zoom, that's where I'll be. We had our 9 o'clock meeting this morning, and that's where I was in my Addison Al-Anon meeting. And when I get to those meetings, I do what used to be done for me every time I walked in a meeting. I'd walk in there and they'd go, oh, Ellen, there you are. And I felt like I really mattered. I mattered in the room. They were glad to see me, even though I felt worthless. You treated me like I mattered. And you know what? After a while, you begin to matter to yourself. I did that this morning in my little Al-Anon meeting. I scroll through the screens and I go, oh, hi, oh, hi, oh, hi, oh, hi. Oh, look, so-and-so's here. Hi, hi, I haven't seen you in so long. We've started a thing in our group where when somebody says, hi, my name is, we all go. rather than, you know, because you can't hear, hi, Ellen, anymore. Oh, that will be heaven when that happens too, when I get to hear that again. But we wave like crazy. We wave when they start and we wave when they finish. It helps in Texas because it's hot here. Anyway, I'm an Al-Anon. I'm so grateful there's such a thing as Al-Anon to be. Mama diagnosed me when I was 17. She said I was boy crazy. And the place she sent me to be safe was Lubbock, Texas. Well, in Lubbock, Texas in 1963, where she sentenced me, the male to female ratio was 7 boys for every girl. I have died and gone to Lubbock. That's what's happened to me there. She sent me for an education. I went looking for him, but I was always looking for him. I always had a him because you couldn't be himless, but I'm always looking for a better one. This one can't be that good. Look who he's with. You know, my bags are always packed, and I went looking for him. Took me 6 months to find him, but I found him because that's how I am. He was married to somebody else and had 2 kids and was 60 pounds overweight, but none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I've really never liked the easy ones, you know, the ones who say, oh, you're so cute. No, get away, get away, get away. I want the ones you have to fight for, the ones you have to earn, the ones you have to make love you. And I could do it too. I get a high every time I say that. It exhausts me because I don't know what I'd do with them these days if I got one. But Anyway, it turns out he was a physical abuser. We were married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit each other. So the reaction I had to it, nobody taught me. Thought it up all by myself in my fabulous little solution center here. And the very best thing I could think to do was double dog daring to do it again. Didn't take any more insanity on his part to hit me the second time than it did the first time. And that's the way we lived. And we lived like that for 9 more years because I'm a sticker. I will make my bed and I will damn near die in it. And I left. And you say, oh my gosh, how did you do that? Well, the reason I did it was because another guy came along. And this one said, you don't have to live like that, which I had heard 100 times already. But you know, what I discovered in Al-Anon, when I could do inventory and I could talk to people, when I finally would talk to people about what happened, I realized I came to understand what happened. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. And every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was I deserved that. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and looked at a black eye or a split lip or a bloody nose and I said, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house another day, another day. Every time that happened in my dis-easiness, a piece of me left and another piece until 9 years later, there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that. So the other one came along and he said, you don't have to live like that. And I love you. The magic words. I realized in Al-Anon, after I'd been here a little while, I developed a second feeling. I came into Al-Anon. I think people either tend to come in angry or hurt. And I came in hurt. Turns out it's the same feeling. It's just whether I'm blowing it out on you or sucking it in on me. It took me a long time to get to anger. I could do rage, but anger took a while. When I heard somebody say, I love you to me, what I heard was, I won't leave you. And that was my worst fear, that I would be left alone. So when this one said, and I love you, don't need number one, cut number two. So I went after that one for a year and nailed him, because that's what I do. You know, when I'm after you, man, you might as well just give it up now. Come on in, because it's going to happen. And he matched my list in my head. I knew what I'd done wrong. And this guy was pretty darn close to perfect. Pretty darn close. He had one flaw that I really couldn't ignore. And that was that he didn't come home some nights. But you know what I didn't know was I was involved with a subset of alcoholic I'd never met before. And that's the bar drinking variety, who is as addicted to the place and the people in it as they are to the substance alcohol. And I was pretty sure, though, a couple of good, you know, home cooked meals and a little, you know, that's the way I used to mark my territory back in the day. Not anymore, of course. Menopause came along and now who cares? Anyway, the night came, for a while, 6 months, 7 months, he came home every night. And the night came, he didn't come home anymore. And I, I was sure it was all about me. If I had just fixed something different for dinner, he would have come home. If he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. If I just moved the TV 2 inches over this way, or if the house was cleaner, if the kids were quieter, then he'd come home. I was sure there was something I could do to get him to come home. And to that end, I decided to sit on the sofa and wait, which is what you do when you're in training for Al-Anon. You have to pass waiting 101. And the way you know you're in waiting 101, when you're waiting, you can't do anything else. You can't talk on a phone. You can't read a book. You can't cook the clothes. You can't cook a meal. Hi, Nancy. Can't do anything. That's how I, that's waiting 101. The kids would come up and they'd go, Mom. And I'd go, shh, can't talk to you because I'm waiting. Because when I'm waiting, I'm listening. And I'm listening for the sound of those tires. There are 44 bazillion other tires on the planet. Don't care. I could pick mine out in a mall parking lot. And I have the same reaction to the sound of those tires as an alcoholic. I've heard alcoholics say a drink would do for them. I'd hear the sound of those tires and I'd go, ah, it's all going to be okay. because he's home now. It's all going to be okay. When I came to Al-Anon, and my first meeting was November 3rd of 1981, coming up, I'm into my 40th year now, and I still don't have enough yet, so I'll be here a while longer. When I came into that group, Al-Anon was different 40 years ago, at least in the Dallas, Texas area than it is today. The deal was, it wasn't a rule, but what we did in that room was everybody went to two Al-Anon meetings and one open AA meeting every week. That was just what you did. And I went, people-pleasing saved my life until it started to kill me. But it saved my life in the beginning because I wanted to please you. I wanted you to love me. I wanted you to accept me. I had never felt accepted, which has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with me and my ability to accept myself. But it's easier to put it on you. You know that. So I went to a bunch of open AA meetings, and I still go to open AA meetings. Another thing I love about Zoom is I can get into a bunch of them. And in those meetings, I heard a truth, and that's that 99 times out of 100, the alcoholic comes home. It might be that day or the next week or 3 years later, but they usually come home. And the one I was married to came home. He came home about 3 hours late and drunk. And I met him at the door like a three-year-old who's cried all afternoon. And you said, stop that. And I was at the place where the snot was slinging, the eyes were all swollen shut, and you know, that attractive place. And I asked him the second stupidest question you can ask. The stupidest, of course, is have you been drinking? But the second stupidest is where have you been? Because my head had already made up a story. My head had already decided that the reason he wasn't home was something horrible, perfectly horrible. And I had all the details in my head. This is not a gift. This is a curse. But my head will make up stories to justify how I'm feeling. Whether how I'm feeling has anything to do with reality or not. I love that. Those words in the big book, it says imagined or real. Real or imagined. A lot of my life was led in imagined. And I had made up a story. And that was the only reason I could figure out that he wouldn't come home, because he said he loved me more than anything in the world. He also said he'd be home for dinner at 6 o'clock, and he wasn't home. My life hung on him loving me more than anything in the world, because I did not want to be, I was terrified to be left alone, absolutely terrified to be left alone. So when I said, where have you been? Really, the only acceptable answer was going to be like in a ditch bleeding someplace. But that's not what he said. He said, you knew where I was. Well, the truth is I knew where he was. He only went three places. He was at home, at work, or in the trap room drinking. But I have the ability to hold opposing thoughts in my head. And they never touch. They never touch. One of them was he loves me more than anything in the world. And the other one is he's in the trap room drinking. But if this one is true, and it had to be because my life depended on it, in my diseasiness, I would rather wish him dead than know the truth. That's what my disease does. So we were married, I don't know how long, 6 years, maybe 5, 6 years. And active alcoholism doesn't get better. It only gets worse. And my diseasiness only got worse. And then I found myself in a place. I was married to the man of my dreams, and I was having an affair with a married man. Wasn't my first one. Damn close to my last one, but it wasn't quite there yet. This is a progress toward perfection. I don't know how I got in there. And when he asked me, the word no never left my mouth. I didn't want to. I did not want to. I hated how I felt, but I could not say no. That's what I got to. And I ended up in Al-Anon, which is another long story. I know very few short stories, so this is a real trick today for me to get this done. Anyway, I ended up in Al-Anon, and I ended up in a group of Al-Anons who would say, listen, so-and-so is doing the steps across town on Thursday nights this month. We're all going to go. We'll come by and pick you up. That's what we did. And we still, it's still done here in Dallas, Texas. You volunteer to do the steps someplace and you go every Thursday or every Wednesday or whatever their night is for a month. And you share how you work the steps with them. And they said, we'll come by and pick you up. And I met them on the curb. I was ready to go. I wanted to go. And it occurred to me after a couple of months of doing that. And I said to my sponsor, I said, you know, I'm leaving my children home alone a lot. And they said, she said, well, condition you're in, that's probably a good thing. You know, and it probably really was that my poor kids got a chance to be out from under their mom's big thumb for a while. So on we went, and the alcoholism got worse. And, you know, there's a thing that it says in our living with an alcoholic, I think it's in the opening, living with an alcoholic was too much for most of us. I always want to say, if it wasn't too much for you, what are you doing here? Why did you have to be here? It was too much for all of us. And even coming to Al-Anon, I was a sick chicken when I got here. Sick chicken. In January of 1984, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was too young. I was 38. There's no history of it in my family. When you took the little checklist, how susceptible are you to cancer? There were only two positives out of 20. One is that I'm female. It has something to do with quantity, is more, has something to do with it. And the other one was that my children are both adopted and I had never given birth. And somehow that made me more susceptible to breast cancer. So that's a long time ago. They gave me a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I did the surgery. I did the chemo. But between the surgery and the chemo, while I was in chemo, I got involved in a step study with other Al-Anons because my life was becoming valuable to me for the first time in my life. My life was becoming valuable. And I had finally, when I was doing inventory, I finally had done inventory several times. And what I came to understand, particularly in a four-step inventory, is I have a part in everything that happens in my life. There aren't some places where I'm helpless victim and other places I don't have a part. Other places where I am responsible. Something happened to me when I was a little girl that I didn't have anything to do with it. And it shouldn't happen to little girls. I didn't invite it. I didn't encourage it. I tried to act like I wasn't there and I never told a soul. But if I want to be free of that, it's my job. That's the part I have. If I want to be free, I'm the one who has to do the work. And I can be free and I am free. And I wanted to know what my part was in the cancer. I don't think I gave myself cancer. I don't think he gave me cancer. I don't think that's what happened, but I knew I had a part and I wanted to know what that was. And what I came to understand after doing that inventory was that it is spiritually too much. It was then too much for me to live in active alcoholism. I was not spiritually capable of surviving. Turns out cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. The people who use the insurance first in an alcoholic home is the non-alcoholic. Alcoholics have blessed moments of blackout where they don't have to be there. Not us. We're awake and paying attention. Some of us are taking notes. I was taking notes when I came to Al-Anon because I thought I knew what was going on, but he told me that wasn't what was happening. And I started to doubt my sanity. So I was taking notes when I got to Al-Anon. Al-Anons have all sorts of stress-related diseases. There were studies then that said cancer was stress-related, and I believe that's exactly what happened to me. I believe that's what happened. As a result of doing that inventory, that in that step study, and going all the way through the steps again, that was probably the second or third time in the time I've been in Al-Anon that I did the steps. For the first time, I was able to say to him, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here, and mean it. And mean it. and be ready not to draw the line, change the line in the sand. That time, for the first time, my life was valuable to me. And I knew that my life was my responsibility. He finally left. He would have told you it was my crazy daughter that anybody had to live with her would drink. She didn't make me want to drink. She made me want to leave home sometimes, but she didn't make me want to drink. She was a teenager, and it turns out that the same months I was doing chemotherapy, she was in the eighth grade, and that's when she started drugs and alcohol. And she just got crazier and crazier and crazier. And meanwhile, I'm trying to recover from cancer, and my focus was on me. It was not on her. Her life would have been very different, I think, if it had been, but it was on me, not on her. And they called me at her school. I thought she was, anyway, they called me from her school one day and they said, there's something the matter with her. Well, duh. There was something raging about her. She turned hot pink and neon orange all of a sudden. And they said, we're going to send her for an evaluation. And the guy from the treatment center called back. She was 17. The guy from the treatment center called and he said, hate to tell you this, Miss Davis, but we do believe your daughter's an alcoholic. And I said, yes. And he said, we don't have a lot of moms who react like that. And I said, oh, I thought she was crazy. That's an Al-Anon symptom. No sign she'll ever get any help for that. But she's alcoholic and she was 17 and I could make her do stuff. We talk about it now and then that you don't want to enable your children. You know what I believe with all my heart? That I can't enable somebody else. I enable myself. I do for somebody else because I'm afraid of how I'll feel if something bad happens to them. And that's why I do that. There's a mom thing I've discovered in Al-Anon too. Moms seem to have to do everything for their kids they can think of before they can let them go. And I could force feed the 12 steps into her is what I could do. So I left her at the treatment center for outpatient and they took her to AA. And that was the only thing I knew that might help her. She got sober. She was pissed at me. She was pretty sure I'm the reason she's alcoholic and she stayed mad at me for a while. I was over her mad. I was over that. So after about some time, a year and a half or something, she started hanging out with slippery places with slippery people. And I thought she'd drink again. And I had that sense, if she drinks, I'll die. I can't live with active alcoholism. I'll die. So for the umpteenth time, I said it for the first time, I meant it. If you can't go by the rules of this house, you cannot stay here. I set the deadline, and the deadline was going to be the day I was going to the Crested Butte Mountain Conference in Crested Butte, Colorado, to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I knew I was going to need support. I did not want to kick my daughter out. I wanted her happy, healthy home and home. She couldn't do any of that. And I changed the locks the day before because she wasn't doing what she needed to do. And that morning, as I'm packing my car, she threw herself across my bed and she said, guess what? You're going to be a grandma. She told me later she thought that was a cute way to tell me. I thought she was making me the responsible party one more time. And we went through some, I don't know how long. It may have been hours, but I hope it was only minutes. I was just really awfully ugly to her. Before I picked up the phone and called my sponsor and turned myself in. And she said, if you don't want her to stay, she doesn't have to stay. There's only so many bad feelings in every relationship. Those are hers. Let her have them. Let her have them. And I'll stay on the phone. You know, my sponsors have done that with me through the years. They'll say, I don't have your answers, Ellen. You have your answers. But I'll stay on the phone while you talk it out. I'm one of those people that processes with my mouth open, sadly, but that's what happens. The upshot of it was, I thought that the kicking her out was what was so painful, but the release is never painful. It's only painful when I'm holding on and it's time to let go. And it was time to let go of her then. And I kept my word. And she moved out, which if you have children, you know that children moving out is really a process. It's not an event. It doesn't just happen and now they're gone. But anyway, she moved out. And We went through a difficult fall. She went around telling people how mean I was, that she was pregnant and I wouldn't let her live at home. And I went around telling people, look what she's doing to me now, because I still felt like she was doing it to me. And I had 7 years of Al-Anon at that point. And a lovely alcoholic man said to me one day, he said, oh, I know exactly how you feel, Ellen. But he said, you know what? Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it. I love babies. I still have not had enough babies in my life. I love them. And God was offering me another baby. But what keeps me from my recovery is the yeah, but. Yeah, but not like this, God. Not today, God. Not my daughter. Not like this, God. I had a picture of how babies ought to come into the world. My journey in Al-Anon's been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. Clint Hodges used to say, acceptance sounded like thank you, God, for everything, exactly as it is. And the truth of the matter is nothing can change until I can accept everything exactly as it is. So I decided to say thank you for the baby. Months later, she called and said, I've had a sonogram today. It's two babies. And I thought, well, you know, alcoholics, if one's good, let's have another. And there we were. Second baby made all the difference in the world. If she'd had one baby, you'd have another speaker, but she had two babies. When they were born, when we brought them home from the hospital, they weighed 5'1" and 4.0 pounds. And I had learned that I'm in charge of my peace of mind. Nobody's going to give it to me. And I was going to have more peace of mind knowing where she and those babies were than having to hunt them down. She didn't even like dolls. And I did not know what she was going to do with two little babies. And she was 18 years old. They were 5 weeks old when she said, well, Mom, I'm not going to keep them. You can have them if you want them. And I can't tell you the torture I went through with that. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and my sponsor had been telling me for years that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts. But I'm so afraid I'll make the wrong decision. What if I pick this thing and the next week something fabulous comes and I can't have it because I picked the stupid thing last week? So I tend to not make the decisions. I let somebody else make them, and then I'm upset with them when it doesn't work out. My sponsor said, oh, honey, you're so confused. She said, your job is walking in the direction of your dreams. Where you get is God's deal. And God's not a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience. God really wants you happy, joyous, and free. So walk in the direction of your dreams. She signed papers and I went to adoption agencies and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. I don't want to be the mom. They're the children of two addicts, and I don't like the odds, but man, I wanted to be grandma. It took us a while to find them. They were 5 months old when we found the couple, and they lived 75 miles north of us, and Melissa thought maybe alcoholism wouldn't catch them there. And they were adopted, and we stayed family. There wasn't a month that went by that we didn't have a meal with them. Christmas came. They came to my house for Christmas. Their stockings hung on my chimney. And Easter, they came and hunted Easter eggs in our yard. And we have big family pictures. Everybody would come over when the twins were here. And they adopted a little girl, and she was now I had a granddaughter. And things were pretty good until the boys went into high school and things started getting a little weird in high school. The family did not want to know about the disease of alcoholism or the fact that these were the children of two addicts. They didn't want to know. They came to one of my meetings one time and they smiled and walked out. And I'm sure they thought, she is crazier than we thought. But okay, fine. After they graduated from high school, the ink wasn't dry on their diplomas before they raced to Dallas from where they were, because this is where they wanted to live, where the life was. And with the older twin, by 30 seconds, he was telling me one day, he must have been about 19 at the time, and he said, you know, I didn't have my first drink till graduation night. He said, I don't understand why Melissa had all that trouble with alcohol. He said, I got some beer in my apartment, but he said, I can take it or leave it. He was 19. By 21, he was a convicted felon. and he was in prison. 5 alcohol-related offenses. My daughter came back into AA in January of 1990, and I had nothing to do with it. AA had everything to do with it. The best thing I ever did for her was get a program and get a life and get out of her way and let her do what she needed to do. She had a wonderful sobriety, wonderful sobriety. And I cannot tell you where she slipped. I can only tell you where she fell. Probably, I don't know when. I'd be lying to you if I told you, but it's probably somewhere around 2010. She ended up diagnosed with breast cancer. She was too young. She was 39. And it wasn't, the only reason they found it was because she was showing a sponsee that there was nothing to fear at mammograms. So she said, I'll go get one with you. Sponsee was fine, but Melissa ended up with a little spot. And she got into pain pills. And the next thing you know, she's taking the kids' ADD medication and she's taking pain pills because she wouldn't let anybody else disperse the pills. I think pain pills are great. I think people ought to use them. But I think if you've got a problem, you ought to let somebody else hand them to you. And she couldn't do that. So that is not where she slipped. She slipped someplace before that, but I don't know where it is. I can only tell you what I saw. She had married and had 2 little boys. She got 2 college degrees. Brilliant. Beautiful. And they had 2 little boys. And then they divorced. And she got more active in AA and married a guy in AA. And they were going to trudge the road together, except that the road had a turn. You know, I read something the other day that said there's no wrong turns. They're just unexpected paths. And they hit an unexpected path. In October of 2013, the younger twin, the baby twin, killed himself driving drunk in a 1-vehicle accident. And his brother's first question when he found out about it was he drinking? Was he drinking? He had told me that the beginning of that summer, he said, Grandma, I think I'm going to stop drinking. He was 25. Who quits drinking at 25 except he's having a problem? But he couldn't stop. And he died drunk. And Melissa went over the edge. She went over the edge when that happened. We had gone in June of 2013 because things are so horrible out at her house. And I had remarried. And I wish to heaven I could talk to you about nothing but the prince. Because I kissed a lot of frogs, but I found a prince. He wasn't alcoholic when I married him. However, 2 years later, he stood up and took a chip and said he was an alcoholic and never had a drink again. I can pick him. I'm just telling you. We were together 30 years, just the best ever. And he had said in June, I think we ought to go get the boys, her 2 younger boys. He said, it's too hard out there for those boys. Let's go get them. And she said, okay, come get the boys for the summer. So we went and got her sons. And then Cameron died and Melissa went over the edge and her boys are still with me. They're 23 and 21 now. They're not boys anymore. And I'm so grateful to have them here. In September of 2016, I'm very active in Al-Anon. I always have been there. There's never been a time for whatever reason that I've had any second ideas about coming to Al-Anon. And I remember one time I told my sponsor, this isn't working. And she told me, she said, what's happening to you is called life. And how you deal with what's happening to you is called your recovery. There's more to do. Your world needs to get bigger. God needs to get bigger. In September of 2016, my husband was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia and given 4 to 6 months to live. At the same time, the oldest grandson went back to prison again, this time with another alcohol-related offense. And they put him in a judicial treatment center with the idea they were going to, my prayer was that he would catch alcoholism in prison, you know. And I don't know that he did, but that's what happened. Melissa's cancer, the cancer she had came back. And I don't know when it came back. I think it came back years before, but, you know, she loved her boys. And she couldn't see them in the shape she was in. And we didn't want them to see her in the shape she was in. So we saw very little of her. She came around Christmas time that year. And with everything, she wanted to get sober more than there are words to tell you. She went to AA meetings right up till then. And she'd been drinking again for a while. But she couldn't do it. And we saw her around Christmas time. And then January, I don't know exactly what happened, but apparently she got a phone call from the oncologist who said the cancer's back and it's everywhere and it's just a matter of months. There's nothing we can do. You know, AA and Al-Anon is not just a way of life. It's a way of death too, because death is part of life. I look at how my husband's last months and I look at her last months, and he was right in the middle of the program. He was right in the middle of 3 12-step programs, because that's what happens in my family. We can give you a lot of opportunity to go work, get a little recovery. And he was very active in them. But she was terrified. She was absolutely terrified. And January 14th of 2017, she took her own life. And I don't begrudge her one second of that. I cannot imagine the pain she must have been in, that was her only way out. It had, but I want to tell you what, you know, I want to tell you, since she died, it's another thing I miss, because we're not gathering in big groups here, but when we're in groups here in the Dallas area, since January of 2017, some alcoholic will come to me, almost always a woman, and she'll come to me and she'll say, "Can you talk about Melissa?" And I'll go, "Yes, please. Could we talk about Melissa?" And they'll say, "Can I tell you what she did for me when I was new sober? I wouldn't be sober today if she hadn't been there." And she had a fabulous sobriety. Every one of those people who have come to me, I know they carry her light. She lives in them. She added life to their life. And sometimes, you know, when it's gotten dark and scary for me, I imagine all these little lights walking around, Melissa's little lights. Well, 3.5 weeks after Melissa died, my husband died. He died on February 8th of 2017. I called the guy at the funeral home when Dick died. And you can see what kind of friends we were by then. He said, "Ellen, we got to stop meeting like this. People are talking." I know. My husband died in a hospice room, surrounded by people who loved him. People in two different 12-step programs were in the room with him when he died. He went out peacefully, like in his sleep, as you would want to. He did. And I have spent the time, almost 4 years since then, with this incredible gratitude. I was struck by it. When it happened, how in the world, of all the billions of souls who have ever been on this planet and ever will be here, how did I get to be her mom? I don't know. I was the only person on the planet she called mom. And every time she said it, I could hear, it just made my heart flutter from the time she was a little bitty baby on. I was telling somebody today, I remember her saying her prayer. She wasn't quite two, because we didn't have my son yet, but she was not quite two, and she was very devout. She said those prayers every night, and she would say, I even have a tape of her saying them. Now, listening to it today, I realized no one else can find one intelligible word on there, but I understood her when she was doing it. And what she would say is, "God bless everybody I love and everybody they love. Amen." That was her prayer. Can't get any better than that. How did I get to be her mom? I am so grateful, God. My life is incredibly bigger because of her. And my husband, you know, he and I both thought we'd married above ourselves. I don't know how I ended up with that prince. He was the funniest man on the planet. You know, Keith kills me. He just kills me dead. My face hurts just thinking about him. I get as tickled at him laughing as I do what he's saying. And we have our own screen names we could probably share with you at some point. We probably won't share them with you today. But when he asked me what my screen name was, I thought, this is too tiny a screen. I really need the bigger screen. And I'd like to be, you know, I had a fabulous name already. Anyway, Dick made me laugh like that. There were times we'd be someplace and very serious things would be going on, and all he'd have to do is look at me, and I got to leave the room because I cannot keep it under control. How did I get to be his wife? I don't know. I have no idea. And he loved my children. When I'd been married to him about 3 years, my daughter gave him a Father's Day card, and she said, "Where were you when I was growing up?" You know, we had to kiss a lot of frogs, but man, we made it to the prince, I'm telling you. 5 weeks to the day after Dick died, our great-grandson, Mason Rodriguez, was born, and I had another baby. God gave me another baby. He is my little rainbow boy. He spent the night with me last weekend. I'm not caught up in sleep yet. He has a baby brother who's just 17 months younger because my granddaughter can't count. But and I couldn't keep those boys if I didn't have these big young men with me, because I can't even lift them, much less walk with them someplace. Mason, I'm telling you, one of the hardest things about COVID is I can count on one hand the number of times I've been able to see him in the last year. And he's growing so fast, both of them. Caden, his baby brother, honest to Pete. Anyway, I have a life today that I didn't even know this is what I wanted when I came to Al-Anon. I didn't know. I didn't know it could be this good. I didn't know that I could be... that I could have a life like this. My sponsor's husband died about 10 years ago, and she, every day that Dick was sick, I called her every day. She's been my sponsor for 20 something years at this point. And she usually says things when she knows I'm going to talk, like, "Listen, don't embarrass me." I won't tell you her name. Just know that I hope to heaven I didn't embarrass her. She walked with me every step of the way, and she would say to me, "Honey, I know how it hurts." And she said, "There is something on the other side." And there's a line in one of our books, and I think it's the Transforming Our Losses book, that says, if we face our losses openly and willingly and honestly, we will find in ourselves a resilience we didn't know we had, not in spite of, but because of. I could never have walked through these last 4 years by myself. I could never have done that. I have a regular meeting on Wednesday nights. Sponsees come to my house. Dick died on a Wednesday. I texted them. He died at 4 p.m. And I texted them and I said, "He just passed. And if you think for 1 minute we're not having the meeting tonight, you're wrong. I need you to come." And there they were. One of my first sponsors, I don't know how she even heard about Melissa, but she was the first one through the door the next morning. She came and sat at my table and she said, "This is not exactly the future we pictured, is it?" "No." She said, "Yeah, I was thinking about something with a beach. How about you?" That's what I was thinking too. Maybe a beach. But my sponsor said, she said, "You're going to find a depth and joy that you never had before." And there's a lot of suffering that has to go. There's a lot of grief. And I learned in Al-Anon early on that when whatever the feeling is that comes, I have to go. I can't block it. I have to allow it to be. And I can inventory and figure out, is this real? Is this not real? Is this based on what's going on? Is this not? Did a lot of writing. Did a lot of writing the first 2 years. A lot of time with my sponsor and determined that I'd spent some time with somebody I sponsor who happened to be a widow as well. And I told her, I have to confess to you that I believe I'm losing my mind and I don't know who else to talk to about this. She said, what's happening? And I told her, she went, widow brain. It'll be gone in about a year and a half. Don't worry about it. Somebody else told me, I told them, you know, I'm not going to take this wedding ring off the rest of my life. And they said, we understand. Keep it on until you need to take it off and the day will come. And the day came only because it was cutting off the circulation and they were going to have to cut it off my hand. So that was the only reason I took it off. But you can still see it. There was no doubt in your mind. And I thought, why does every widow who comes along have to reinvent this wheel? So there are now 20 of us and we're Al-Anons. Some of them are AA. And we have a meeting we call the Now What's. Now what? And we get together every month and we talk about what's working and what's not working. And, you know, we share experience, strength, and hope. It is, we laugh, we cry, but we share it with each other. And it is amazing to me. What acceptance sounded to me, the way it sounded to me as I'm going through those first year, 2 years, after they died, it sounded to me like, even this, God, even this, I have to surrender to you. Even this has got to be okay in your world. I don't know how, God, I don't know how this fits, but I need you to be big enough for this to fit in your world. And that's how I found acceptance, you know, was willing to let my God get bigger so my world could get bigger. And I used to think, look at us, Keith, this is going to be great. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape and let me see how her husband and her children turned out. And if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, they've earned their way. She's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. I'm so grateful that you let me find another God. I have a story about what's going to happen when I leave here. Of course I do. But my sponsor said I can have this story. I think when my little body gets tired of doing whatever it is in the world we're doing here, and that little piece of me that's always been God's goes to where God is. When I get there, God is going to go, oh, Ellen, there you are. He's going to say, you know what, precious? Heaven's heaven when you're not here. But it's just not perfect without you. Why would God make me feel less welcome than you do? Why? He's going to say, I've been running a little experiment. It really is not a test. It's nothing you could pass or fail. It was just a little experiment. And I know you've been paying close attention. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions and get your opinion. God wants my opinion. That's heaven. First thing he's going to say is, did you have a good time? You know, I didn't do a single thing to torment you. I really wanted you happy, joyous, and free. There was no reason for flowers to be different colors, except I thought it'd make you smile. And I knew you'd love babies. I put a lot of them in your life. I hope you didn't miss them. Because if you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God, I had a great time at your party. Thanks for asking me. And the second thing he's going to say is, were you Ellen? You were the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do. And that worried me because I'd spent so much of my life trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be that I didn't know whether I'd been me or not. And I do a written inventory at night. And one of the lines I did for a number of years said, today, Ellen. And I would write down the one thing I did that day that I knew was mine to do. This was mine to do. You could have had another speaker and probably Keith wouldn't be worried about whether we're going to end on time or not, but that's not what happened. You got me. This was mine. I looked back at the list of things that I put there, and 95% of it's what you call service work. I knew when I was doing service work, I was exactly where God would have me be. And the last thing he's going to ask me is, precious, did you ever get the joke? I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke. Standing in the back door of my house in the middle of chemo, having lost all the hair on my body, friends, I will not get descriptive, but you know what I mean. All the hair on my body, except the 6 white hairs I had at the time. They didn't fall out. Never occurred to me to cut them. They were all the hair I had, but they were kind of like wispy nerve endings. So I wore hats when I went out. I didn't want to offend you with my nerve endings. And I had a hot pink neon orange daughter who was living over the edge of the planet at that point. I had a beige and navy blue son who slept more during the day and was awake at night to avoid being in our crazy family. And I had a husband who'd say, "What's for dinner?" And he might not come home for 3 weeks. And I had a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I got ready to walk out the house and go buy something, a plant to plant in my yard. And I looked down at my legs and I had to go back in and shave my legs. What? What? And you know what? I laughed and I laughed and I laughed. I could hear God rolling around the floor of heaven going, "Gotcha, gotcha. Been working on that one, gotcha." What I finally understood was one day at a time. What I finally understood is I spent most of my life trying to hold on to things I thought I had to be okay, or trying to get something that I thought I had to be okay, that I almost missed the truth, which is right now, in every now that I will be present in right now, I have everything I need. God has prepared me for everything that's coming along. I have everything I need. I might not have had it 5 minutes ago, but I got it now. Maybe all I have is the ability to hold up my hand and ask for help, but it's all I need now. That was the joke. It's another reason why I try. One of my most sincere prayers is, God, don't let me get in the way of somebody else's spiritual experience. I don't know what they're being prepared for. I don't know what these young men are being prepared for. I don't know what my other grandchildren are being prepared for. My job is to love them right where they are. And that's hard some days. That's hard some days. But that's my job. And to trust that the same God that has prepared me will prepare them for what they need. There's a guy in our group that says the glass isn't half full or half empty. The glass is just too damn big. There's another one who said the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. The magic that happens here in our amazing program is that somehow when I pour out my cup, when I finally am quiet, I'm the one whose cup overflows. And I thank you. Thank you.
Oh my, Ellen, you've done it again.